ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So, we've been looking at where we spend our time, where we place our attention, why we do that, why we place our attention where we do. And we've seen some of the qualities of samsara. Samsara means a spinning around, a cycle. It can mean the endless cycle of birth and death, as is traditionally viewed. It can mean this endless attempt to become on this hedonic treadmill where we keep running and we think we're making progress, but we're really ending up in the same place. And we saw that this urge, this push, this pressure, this itch to continue this struggle to become adequate is based on the conclusion that I am inadequate. I can look at all of my qualities and they're all lacking. I'm mortal. I'm insecure. Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm not. And there's all these things I want to fill those holes. And we looked and we saw that there doesn't seem to be an inherent happiness attribute in anything that we pursue. There's nothing that has the intrinsic attribute of happiness, like fire has the intrinsic attribute of heat. There's nothing there. So we're examining our experiences. And we're coming up short. We're saying that our investment of life and time is not returning, it's not returning what we think it should. And so really what we're looking, what's happening is that there's a bit of vairagya, there's a bit of, and we'll go into what that means in a bit, but there's a bit of objectivity towards these things, because we're seeing that as much as they're advertised, as much as we advertise them to ourselves or they're advertised to us, they don't quite fit the bill. They're not doing as promised. There's a buyer's remorse often. But we do have an inkling that there's a solution, right? And so there's a number of ways that that inkling comes about. If you're in a traditional Vedic society, you will have spent a good number of years learning your Veda, chanting. The Veda is the sacred scriptures of India, and it's an oral tradition. And so you learn the Vedas, and in those Vedas, it's a huge, voluminous work, and you learn, traditionally, you can learn just a portion of it, and you can chant for hours and hours and days and days. And the first part of the Vedas deal with action and ritual and homas. And the last part of the Veda, Vedanam Antaha, the end portion of the Vedas, Vedanam Antaha is Vedanta. And in that Vedanta, it's the Upanishads. And in those Upanishads, it says, Atma Vid Shokam Tarati. It says, hey, there's a problem and there's a solution. So you have this general knowledge. You go, oh, well, I have some faith in what these shastras, what these texts say. I have faith in my elders. They say this is true. I see some teachers and they seem to be very happy and very complete in saying this. So maybe there's something to it. And we'll go into what Shraddha is. But so far we've talked about Shraddha as just temporarily putting aside the internal scaffolding that filters out the true message of what's being said and through which we try to see any new idea. So if we can put those filters aside, we can see more clearly just what's being said. And so this is introducing another level of that called, it's a guru Shastra Bhakyeshu Vishwasaha, which just means a simple trust in the words of the guru and the words of the scriptures. Now, if you don't, if you're not brought up in an Indian culture where you have that in that cultural milieu where that's a given, that these scriptures are sacred, we still say in the West or in other parts, or even in India, I've known a number of people who've just had what Swamiji likes to call paperback knowledge, right? You read some Alan Watts, or you read some translation of the Gita or the Upanishad, or other traditions where they say that your inadequacy is not inherent to you. There's a lot more to this. And so it's worth pursuing, it's worth taking, it's worth, well worth your while, to understate it. It's well worth your while to look at what you're doing and to see that there's more and there's hope, right? And then we also looked at Ananda. We looked at, we did a little bit of Ananda Vichara, Sukha Vichara, saying we actually also just happenstantially get moments of happiness. And so we start to see that there's no direct correlation or cause-effect relationship between desirable things and my happiness, because I can be miserable in the presence of happy things that I think will cause me happiness, and I can be happy in spite of the absence of those happy things. I can be happy even in the presence of things that should cause me misery. And I can be happy for no reason when I see a sunset. I can be, even in simple meditation, if you learn some meditation and the mind just becomes a little quiet, a little sattvika, you go, oh, there seems to be an inherent happiness there, but it's so hard to hold on to what's going on there. So the paperback knowledge is called apatattaha jnanam. It's just happenstantial knowledge. It's like, it's actually grace. Because who are we to have this, especially in cultures where we don't necessarily have, you know, we've maybe have become alienated from our own religious tradition, or our own religious traditions don't quite fit anymore. And then we start seeking something more. And then we get this message that there is a potential solution. So what we've been looking at so far is basically the first two of what are traditionally presented as four purusharthas. We've been talking about kama. Kama is desire, desirable things, pleasure, enjoyments. There are four that have been identified. It's a descriptive model. It's not prescriptive. It's not saying one should pursue these things. It's saying humanity pursues these things. These are the things that we all look at, we all pursue. It's called purushartha. Sarvaihi purushaihi artyate iti purushartha. Sarvaihi purushaihi, by all people, artyate, prartyate, it is sought after, it is prayed for, it is desired. Iti purushartha. These are the four things. And so we looked at kama, which are the pleasurable things. And we've looked some at artha. Artha here means wealth. It means security, actually. And so we seek our security because we feel insecure. We're mortal, right? We seem to be always on the precipice of danger, of mortality. You know, every day is a gift. And so we seek some financial security. And the financial security gives us some power. You know, some people seek power, political power. But, you know, and there's nothing wrong with pursuing enjoyable things, and there's nothing wrong with looking for financial security. It gives us, you know, it's two of the primary items in Maslow's hierarchy, right? You need to go on to bigger things. You need to have food, and you need to have some shelter. But we see that they don't solve the problem. They don't really address the fundamental problem, and they can be great distractions, because if that's our value, then that's all we spend our time doing. In fact, there is the people who only pursue these two things are called prakriti purusha. Prakriti means, to put it gently, natural people who live an unexamined life. Prakriti. Samskrita means refined. Samskrita, krita means done or created. Some brings in the idea of a refined, it's a refined language, and it's a refined people. And Prakriti comes from Prakriti, which just means a natural person. This is just what people naturally look at, these two things. And even animals pursue these things. There's actually the Charvakas, which are a school of thought, materialist thought, and they have this very, very interesting shloka. Yavat jivet sukham jivet ranam kritva kritam bibet bhasmi bhutasya dehasya punar agamanam kutaha. And it says, the Swamiji loves to quote this one. Yavat jivet, as long as one lives, yavat jivet sukham jivet, one should live happily, one should live with pleasure. Sukham jivet, as long as one lives, one should just pursue pleasure. Rinam kritva, building up the debt, incurring all sorts of debt, maxing out those credit cards. Gritam bibet, may one drink ghee. What is drinking ghee? Ghee is clarified butter. Ghee is a very rich, is a metaphor for living a very rich life. You know, ghee, you just have all this rich food, all these rich enjoyments. You drink, you party, in whatever culture, you just have a good time. Because bhasmi bhutasya dehasya punar agamanam kutaha. Where is coming back when the body has been burnt into ashes on the funeral pyre? There's no coming back. All it is to live hedonistically at the moment, for the moment. And so they seek artha, they seek power, they seek wealth, they seek enjoyments, because when you're gone, you're gone. Charvaka. One whose speech is charu is very pleasant to hear for some people. Now there's the third purushartha, which we haven't talked about, but to create this whole context here, we should look at dharma. Dharma artha kama. Dharma. Dharma can mean several things. It can just mean an attribute. But here it means ethics. And it's a very simple heuristic for ethics. Swamiji's fond of saying you don't need rules to tell you how to behave. It's just very simple. It's based on common sense. And basically, it's the golden rule. It is, don't do to another person what you wouldn't want them to do to you. And do for another person, do for other people, what you would like them to do for you. It's very simple, right? It's God-given. In the sense, it's very natural. We know, we have that touchstone, is that we don't want to be lied to. We don't want to be physically hurt. We don't want our things stolen from us. So don't do it to anybody else. So dharmika karma, dharmic actions, are those which produce or nurture harmony. They nurture and create understanding and appreciation, in the context of an appreciation of the order for how things are. It's a given. It's part of the order that I want certain things done to me and I don't want certain things done to me. And so you respect this order of things by your action, by doing things in accordance with that order. Adharmic activities, on the other hand, increase divisiveness, increase disharmony, and do not honor that natural order of things. It actually reinforces samsaritvam. Adharmic activities reinforce this notion that I am a limited being and I need to do things which are contrary to my conscience, run contrary to my conscience, because I'm so needy and I need so much more to fill these holes in my soul. So, for example, let's say I'm walking down the street and I see someone's purse on a table as I walk by. Now, I could just walk on by and do nothing. You could say that's dharmic. I mean, it's marginally so, because I don't take it. A dharmic thing to do might be to go knock on the person's door and say, hey, you know, there's a purse here. You may want to bring it inside because there might be money in there. And because that's what I would want, you know, at the very least, I'd want somebody to walk by without taking it. I would prefer that someone come and tell me that, you know, I'm susceptible to theft here. And so please come, and, you know, put it someplace safe. the adharmi, the one who does adharma, would say, oh, here's an opportunity for me to gain more artha, to gain more wealth at the cost of another person. And so he or she might take it and run away. But at what expense, right? That person who needs to steal that money, there's always exceptions. We'll talk about that. But if someone says, okay, I'm going to steal this because then I could buy a nice stereo or something, or an iPad, or I won't keep picking on Apple, an Android phone. You know, they have this desire. What they're doing, you're actually objectifying the other person. You're making that other living human being into an object whom you can sacrifice. You can sacrifice another person's well-being for your own well-being because you are so needy. You feel so lacking, so inadequate, that the boundaries of propriety are easily crossed, and you can easily hurt somebody because you need that so badly to feel adequate about yourself. So they say that ahimsa is the paramo dharmaha. Ahimsa paramaha dharmaha. It's the primary dharma, and all the other ones follow. Ahimsa is non-injury. You don't want to hurt anybody in thought, word, or deed. Manasa, kayika, vachika. Manasa, mentally; vachika, verbally; kayika, bodily. You don't want to cause any harm to anybody. And all the other ones come from that. In the Yoga Sutra, right, we see that. What are the eight limbs, right? Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhyaha, ashtau angani. These are the eight limbs, and begins with yama, which are the restraints. The first yama is what? Ahimsa. Ahimsa, satyam, asteya, right? Brahmacharya, aparigraha. Ahimsa. It's the very basic, it's the very cornerstone for any spiritual tradition. And so to not hurt people, one very beautiful exercise is called vak tapas. Vak means speech, tapas means a spiritual discipline. Because if we're able to have some say over what comes out of our mouth, we not only bless other people, and we don't do harm, we actually bless ourselves. They say that speech, vak tapas, Krishna says, it's speech should be satyam, priyam, and hitam. Satyam means truthful. That's necessary but not sufficient to have nonviolent speech. Satyam, because you could tell somebody, oh, you're really ugly. That's injurious. It may be true, in my opinion, but that's not a good thing to say. That causes somebody harm. So on top of being satyam, truthful speech, speech should be beneficial. Hit them. What benefit is it to me to tell somebody that they don't meet my cultural standards of beauty? And the last thing it should be is priyam. It should be sweet. It should be sweet, sweet words, beneficial and truthful. And that actually is a beautiful discipline because it helps give us some control over a very spontaneous mechanism that we have to express what's in our mind, which may not be the most beautiful or beneficial thing for a given situation. So this is called vak tapas. Vak means speech. Tapas means a spiritual discipline, austerity. And this is one way we can manifest ahimsa. It's to make sure that our words are these. They say only a teacher and a parent have the permission to say speech that is apriyam, which may be distasteful, because teachers and parents have the obligation to teach their children, to teach their students. But it still has to be satyam, truthful, and still has to be hit them, beneficial. Some people you may have a relationship with where, you know, I want people to speak truthfully to me. I want people to say things that are beneficial to me, even if it may cause me some harm, you know, some uncomfortableness, even though I might be insulted. But you can't assume that you have that contract with everybody. you have may have that contract with a few people, you have to be very cautious about that. So looking at dharma a little more deeply, there's samanya dharma and vishesha dharma. Samanya dharma is a general rules, the general dharma. And vishesha dharma is the particular rules, how you apply that general rule, that general heuristic in a specific sense, right? Parama dharma, the overriding rule is cause no harm, cause no harm. So you look at, for example, a thief. A thief might come up behind you and knock you unconscious. He may take a knife and cut you, and then he may take your money, and you may never see him again. Dharma, a dharma. It's pretty straightforward, right? A dharma. That person so needed this money for whatever you know, lack that they felt, that they caused this harm to you. And in fact, seeing it that way really helps develop compassion. You wonder how people can do such horrible things. And you can start to develop compassion for those people who seem so adharmic, because really they're suffering. Really the cause of their adharmic actions are this intense suffering, and you start having compassion for them. It's a very fierce practice to think that, to try that. So now the Samanya Dharma says he shouldn't have done that. Now the Vishesha Dharma might be different. Look at a surgeon. A surgeon will knock you out. A surgeon will take a knife and cut you open. A surgeon will then take your money and you may never see him again. Dharma or adharma? Dharma. He's opening you up to do good. He's opening you up to do this quadruple bypass, because you've been a charvaka and been drinking all that ghee, and now you have all your arteries are clogged up. So there's samanya, general, and then there's vishesha. And in each situation, it's really a challenge to say what is the proper action. Sometimes it's very clear, right? And sometimes it's more of a challenge. And when you look at it, so let's say someone falls, you know, I'm walking down the sidewalk and someone falls down in front of me. I go to help that person. You know, that's the dharmic thing to do. The adharmic thing might be just to walk away and ignore it or to laugh. But when you look at this entire creation, and this, we'll go into this much more deeply later, but every kartavyam, you know, the thing to do, everything that presents itself as something to do, when I see that elderly person who's fallen down, it's my duty I feel it's my duty to help lift them up, to see if they're okay. Kartavyam, it's my thing to do, it's my dharma to do that. And in every kartavyam, in every situation that presents itself that is eliciting actions from me to respond in appropriate and a loving and compassionate giving way, you can think of that as the Lord coming to you. Every opportunity is that every that presents itself as an opportunity for personal growth, for emotional maturity, and in a sense, in a very real sense, to worship, because that's a given. I didn't ask for that person to fall down in front of me, but there it is. Right? And so in that moment, that's my sadhana. That's my spiritual practice. If I say, oh, that person may not want me to, or you know, so that person may sue me if I do something wrong, that value for helping another person may not be fully assimilated. So every opportunity that presents itself, you can see as Dakshinamurti coming, the Lord as teacher, to teach you a lesson. And if you have a well-assimilated value for ahimsa and for helping and for honoring what needs to be done, then you just act spontaneously and your actions are spontaneously good. So another way to look at dharma is from a purely religious sense. So every action produces, the Shastra talks about, the scriptures talk about, every action produces a result, a karmapala. Pala means fruit. Pala just means, it can mean a banana, an apple. It just literally means a fruit. But it means a result. Karma means action. Karma phala means the result of an action. Every karma has a result. And that result can be immediate or not immediate. It's called drishta and adrishta, seen and unseen. And that immediate result, let's say I feed somebody who's hungry. The immediate result for that is, that comes back to me, that graces me, is I see the look in that person's face. I see them enjoying the food. I see them becoming satiated. I see their hunger go away. That blesses me. That's, I get my happiness from that. And the other problem is that they're not hungry anymore. So that is a drishtapala. And they also say that there's adrishtapala, there's unseen result. And through your actions, you gain unseen results, which then fructify, to continue the fruit metaphor, fructify in the afterlife or in the next life. So there's a model which we'll go into about presenting about, which you're probably all familiar with, about rebirth. And, you know, the Shastra talks about seven heavens and seven hells. And it says that if you do good, if you do dharma, if you promote harmony and love and understanding and compassion and don't objectify other people, it will reward you not only in your experience this life, but it helps determine what sort of afterlife you have. And then it helps determine the trajectory of your next birth. If you do the opposite of that, you might not have such a pleasant time in the hereafter, and you might not be born into such an advantageous situation in your next life. So this is called punya. The first is called punya. The second is called papam. You know, I should write some of these words down. I should go through all the classes and create some dictionary or classes, because I know I use a lot of Sanskrit words. I'm trying to translate them all as I go, but sometimes I may not. I apologize. So papam is the demerit you earn that becomes part of your account. And the punya does too, the merit, which helps shape your future experiences. So if you do dharma, what do you get? You get punya. And the scripture talks about other ways to get punya by certain rituals and other certain actions. So one way to look at dharma in this context is as religious obligations to give you a better afterlife. That's another sort of more narrow way to look at this. You can do artha, you can pursue artha and kama, you can pursue wealth and pleasure within the confines, within the constraints of dharma. You don't hurt other people to do it, right? That's called living a virtuous life, living a normal virtuous life. Nothing wrong with that. The Veda talk all about that, but it doesn't solve the problem. Even if you take dharma to mean justice, which you can, you know, you fight for justice all your life, it's still a limited action, it's still a limited result. And so you're better off pursuing kama and artha within the constraints of dharma, but they still don't solve the fundamental problem, because the fundamental problem is that I take myself to be inadequate. And so really, the person who seeks to address the fundamental problem in a fundamental way, right, sees through all these other things, sees that really what they're looking for is what's called moksha. And this is the fourth purushartha. This is the fourth thing. Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Freedom. The one who wants moksha, the one who wants freedom from this intense need to become something other than what I am, is called a mumukshu. Sanskrit's beautiful. It has this sun. It has this modification you can make to any verb, which is called the sun, which is called desiderative. And you can, it means I desire something. So bubukshu is one who desires food. A mumukshu is one who desires moksha. So when you start looking at what kama can bring you, what artha can bring you, what even dharma can bring you, the highest heavens, you're still going to come back from heaven. That's the thing. Any action that you do is limited, and therefore any result of any action is going to be limited. Limited action cannot produce unlimited results. So if you go to heaven, as the Shastra talks about, or any afterlife, your experiences are determined by your actions. You have limited actions. You have limited results. You have a time-bound vacation. You can go to the highest heaven and really live it up, but you're going to come back because you have the same problem, because you take yourself to be this inadequate person. So in reality, all everybody is looking for is moksha. We just don't know it. We're looking to solve the fundamental problem of my self-concept of inadequate self, but we're going through all the wrong ways. And so really, when you stop and look at it, really what I'm looking for is moksha. I'm a mumukshu. I want to solve the fundamental problem. So what is the solution? What is the locus of the error? If the locus is external, I can solve the problem externally. And the efficacy of the solution is in keeping with the effort, right? So let's say I want to make a dinner. Let's say I'm hungry. So I can open a can of beans and eat it cold. That will solve that problem of hunger. That problem, even though it seems to live in me, it's not. The problem is outside the lack of food. So I go and I eat the food. I may not enjoy a cold can of beans. I can make an 8-course meal, and the problem of that action, that solution to the problem of hunger, will be dependent on my ingredients, will be dependent on my skills, and will be dependent on my knowledge. And I'll have a very beautiful dinner. But it solves an external problem. How is any external action going to solve the problem of my mortality, of my ignorance, of my unhappiness? So if the problem is centered on me, and Swamiji says, the problem is you, the solution is you. So I must be inherent in the solution. The Shastra says, tat tvam asi, tat tvam asi, tat, that, tvam, you, asi, are. The whole Tattva Bodha we're going to be looking at talks about this tat tvam asi. All of Vedanta is this one statement, you are that. What is the you we need to look very closely at? And that's what the first section of the Tattva Bodha book is, the Atma Vichara, the nature of the individual. You, asi, are, tat, that. What is that? Right now, let's say that is what you want to become. You are that which you want to become. How is this? Let's say, how is the problem me? We've seen how the problem is me. How is the solution me? You are the solution to your problem. Let's say there's three of us walking down a path and it's dusk and I'm walking down with two of my friends, a husband and a wife, and the husband has cataracts. He can't see very well. And the wife's vision is very, very eye, very keen-eyed. She has good, clear vision. And we're walking down the road and I look, it's kind of dark. It's about sunset. We're taking our evening constitutional. I look and I say, oh my goodness, there's someone up there. Oh my goodness, that person has a giant club and a weapon. Oh my goodness. And I turn around and I say, run. And the other two kind of look at me funny and they just keep walking. And the woman says, you're silly. Come here. What's the situation here? The situation is that there's really just a tree stump. Right, a dead tree, and it has a branch that looks like an arm, and on that branch is another branch that looks like a club. I saw a man who was going to attack us with a club. Now, the fellow who had the cataracts didn't run. Why didn't he run? He saw nothing. He experienced nothing. How about the woman? Why didn't she run? Because she saw things clearly as they were. She saw that there was just a tree. There is no problem. There's no problem for the man with the cataract. There's no problem for the man with the for the woman with the who saw the tree. There was just a problem for me. And why was that problem there for me? Because I did not have knowledge of what was there. There was avarna shakti. There was the covering of what was there. Ignorance. I was ignorant that there was a tree there. And on top of that, I was able to project something that wasn't there. I was able to project, that's called avarana and vikshepa shakti. Vikshepa shakti is what what allows you to project something that's not there. So I was the one who had that problem. I was the one who had the problem of samsara. If I am not completely available to myself, like an animal, you know, animal self is really not, they're not self-reflective. They don't have the ability to form a self-concept upon which they can make a judgment of inadequacy. There's no problem there, like the person with the cataracts. For one who truly knows oneself, there's no problem because what is seen, it is seen clearly. It's only I who don't really know my true nature. My true nature is covered by ignorance, and therefore I am able to project all this inadequacy on myself, and it causes me so much turmoil. That robber, that thug that I projected onto that tree stump based on my ignorance of that tree caused me all sorts of turmoil. And what I needed was that jnanini. Jnanam. Jnana means knowledge. A jnani is a man who has knowledge, often used for both genders. A jnanini, this woman, that's a feminine form of a jnani, jnanini. She's the one who says, come, 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 daksha, don't be such a fool. Shines a flashlight and say, look, look here, right? Look here. And I go, oh, how foolish of me. I was just a tree. There was no problem all along. That will become very apparent that really there is no problem. It's just a matter of my ignorance. So something that is totally unperceived cannot be the locus of an error. So if I see something and don't recognize it for what it is, taking it to be something other than what it is, it leads to a mistake as to the nature of that object. So one who sees, who recognizes that the problem rests on me and it rests on the ignorance of myself, he recognizes that the problem is me, and therefore he recognizes that solution is me, and that is a mumukshu. That is one who looks to oneself for the solution. And actually they say that, you know, if you really see this problem clearly, you will be what's called a dipta shira, one who's shiras, one whose head, whose hair is on fire. It's a common imagery. When your hair is on fire, you don't wander around saying, oh, I wonder what I should do next. You go and you jump in that lake as fast as you can because you want release. You want to solve this problem. It's not just a casual endeavor. You know, there is pain in not solving this problem. So how do we solve this problem? We've talked about the purusharthas, and the fourth one being moksha. Now, how do we gain that moksha? Is it, as I mentioned last week, is it a belief? Is it an experience? Is it an action? Is it knowledge? So let's take belief. Belief, what is a belief? A belief is a judgment, an assessment, prior to knowledge, pending verification. A judgment before knowledge, pending verification. And why do I need to believe in something? Because it's distant. It's distant from me. It's not directly available to me. It's distant in time, in space, or there's some obstacle by keeping me from seeing something. So I need to believe in something. So when there's no direct means of knowledge, something is open to being believed in or not. Let's say I believe that the moon is made of green cheese. Apparently, that has been around for centuries, this notion that the moon is made of green cheese. I don't know if anybody actually thought about that. Green actually here means unripened cheese. And there are whole fairy tales around that. The moon is made of green cheese, so I believe that. I belong to a cult where 200 years ago we thought the moon was made of green cheese, and I can believe that because that's an unverifiable belief. There are also verifiable beliefs. This is an unverifiable belief until we went to the moon. And the first Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. Let's see, he belonged to this cult. Oh, I'm going to go get some green cheese. He lands on the moon. He picks up the rocks. He goes back to his space capsule. He takes off his space helmet. He opens a bag of rocks. He puts one in his mouth. And what does he find? He comes back to me and he says, you know, you're a fool. We've all been fools. The moon is not made of green cheese. The moon is made of moon dirt. So that was a belief where there was no direct means of knowledge. It was distance in terms of space. It was pending verification, and then it was verified that no, indeed, it is not made of green cheese. So beliefs are subject to verification. Some beliefs, like heaven, you know, that there is rebirth, that there is heaven. Right now, that is unverifiable. We'll talk about why it's not an irrational belief. Beliefs don't have to be irrational, like the moon is made of green cheese. Beliefs can have a very solid underpinning and make sense in different ways. They can be logical as well, or they can be illogical. Let's say I tell you that I'm a God man. God talks to me in my sleep. So believe what I say, and you don't have to worship me. But you know, the smart people, if they have a God man in their neighborhood, they're going to worship them. But no, you don't have to worship me. How do you verify that? I don't know. Whole religions are made on claims like this. And we don't really know. So, you know, some people say, oh, it's better to believe than not believe. Better play it safe. It's not wrong. It's just good to know that some beliefs are verifiable and some aren't. So let me ask you, how many fingers am I holding up? You can believe I'm holding up two fingers. There's no way for you to tell. You can't see anything. Now, how many fingers am I holding up? So now I'm holding fingers up, but it's covered up by my hand. How many fingers? How many do you want to believe? Do you believe? Do you believe I'm holding up two fingers? I'm holding up two fingers. Now how many fingers am I holding up? I take my hand away and you see I have three fingers. Do you need to believe that I'm holding up three fingers? Yes, I need to believe you're holding up three fingers. You don't need to believe that I'm holding up three fingers. You see, you know. My fingers are directly available to your means of knowledge, which are your eyes. I don't need to believe. So I could have been holding up two fingers and your belief would have been correct. I was holding up three fingers, so your belief wasn't accurate, but now you see. Now you see the truth of what there is. Belief is a judgment prior to knowledge pending verification. Oftentimes belief discourages questioning. Why is the moon made of green cheese? Oh, that's just the way it is, just believe. Why is it green? Why isn't it yellow cheese? We don't ask those sorts of questions. It's written here. That's what is written here. You just need to believe it. Don't ask questions. This teaching is not a belief. It encourages questions. It's all in the form of a dialogue. And in Mananam, you just ask questions and ask questions and ask questions. And so why can we do that? Because I, as a self-conscious, as a conscious being, an existent conscious being, the object of the first person singular pronoun, I, the first person singular pronoun, I, the object of that pronoun is me. So I always am. Now, I may take myself to be, and we'll go into this a lot more, I may take myself to be something that comes and goes, that changes over time, but really the I never goes. There's never a time that I can say, I do not exist. I am. So I'm always available. And because I'm always available, I'm subject to ignorance. I'm subject to misinterpretation, if you will. I'm subject to projecting something that I'm not on me. So I'm not distant and I don't require belief. I'm here for Atmavichara, for inquiry into the nature of the self. And Vedanta is that means for the inquiry into the nature of the self. We're all like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, right? So some of you, I hope, have seen The Wizard of Oz. If you haven't, you should see it. It's, I think, a 1930-something movie, and it was something we look forward to seeing every year on television. And she needed to go back home, and she felt that she needed to go do something. She needed to go see this holy man, who ended up being a faker and who ended up not being able to take her home, right? She needed to do things. She needed to go on this venture. She had so many things to do before she could go home. And then someone told her, no, you just have to believe. You just have to believe You just have to believe. Do you have to believe? Did she need to believe to go back to Kansas? No, all she needed to do was wake up. She didn't go anywhere. She was always in Kansas. She didn't need to go to Kansas. She was always there. The only thing that was keeping her from being in Kansas was her ignorance, was her sleep, that she was asleep. So all she needed to do was to wake up. Look at a wave. There's this little wave on the ocean, and the little wave says, I am this tiny, small little wave. I have all these big waves around me. I feel so inadequate. That wave is a beautiful wave. This wave is a powerful wave. I see my destiny on the shore. I'm going to fall into pieces and just disappear. I can't see behind me. I don't know where I came from, but I know this life is short. And another wave comes up, a guru wave, a teacher wave comes up and says, oh, you don't have to worry. There's a solution to this problem. What's the solution? The solution is that you are water. You are not time bound. You are the truth of the entire ocean. Oh, the wave says, I need to believe that I'm the truth of the entire ocean. I need to believe it. I need to believe it. I need to believe it. Does he? Does the wave need to believe that it's water? No, the wave needs to just stop. Well, if a wave can stop, the wave can have faith in the guru's words. The wave can have trust in what the teacher is saying. Say, ah, he may be onto something. By Jove, he may be speaking some truth. Let me look into it. Let me listen. Let me see what he has to say. And so the teacher wave will show him all the waves, all the ways that he is just water. All it needs to do is to see the reality that the wave is nothing but water. Moving on to experience. So what's an experience? So we don't need to believe something about ourselves. We're always available. We need to understand the nature of ourselves. Do we need a different experience? Do we need a new experience? We experience ourselves sometimes as being a Sukhi, sometimes as being a Dukhi. Sometimes we're a happy person, sometimes we're unhappy. How do we reconcile this? Our experience seems to be all over the place. An experience is a direct perceptual participation in an event. A direct perceptual participation in an event, whereas knowledge is a grasping of what is. They're two different things, and it's very difficult sometimes to tease them apart. Experiences come and go. Knowledge doesn't come and go. Knowledge can contradict experience. Experience can contradict each other. Experience can apparently contradict knowledge, but knowledge can resolve the contradiction in our experience. Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad. Let's look at this. I can still have experience and be ignorant. Like when we were walking down the path, I experienced that tree. I had an experience, but I had no knowledge of what that was. I was ignorant of what that tree was, and so I was able to see this thug there. The person with the cataracts had no experience. The Jnanini, this woman who saw things clearly, had both the experience, because every piece of knowledge is based on experience, right? Experience can be part of knowledge. In that there was a perceptual experience. There was an experience of the tree, but there was also the cognition that this is a tree. For me, I had an experience of something, and I was ignorant of what that was. And then when she says, oh, look at this, this is just a tree, then I go, ah, now I have knowledge of what that is. It contradicts my experience. Look at the sunset. So I'm on the equator. And let's say I'm just freshly born as 21-year-old and I've never seen the sunset before. I go and I look and I see the sun, which seems to give me warmth, going into the ocean, into the Pacific. That's scary, right? If I've never seen it before, when is the sun going to come back? It's starting to get cold. It can cause all sorts of problems. Let's say I go to the North Pole to visit Santa Claus. And I'm up in the North Pole, and sometimes in the North Pole, the sun never sets, right? The sun just goes around in circles. So I can have two separate experiences, two contradictory experiences. The sun falls into the ocean. Oh, and then it seems to come back up the other side, and then it falls back into the ocean. And another one seems to come up on the other side. Sometimes it's the same sun just going around in circles. Which is true? Which experience is true? The knowledge, the simple knowledge of astronomy, resolves both contradictory experiences. The truth does not lie in either one of the experiences, but neither of those experiences is completely false, because if I know that the earth rotates, and that's what causes this perception of the different behavior of the sun, both of those contradictory experiences resolve in that knowledge. So experience is and knowledge can be related, but experience can be dumb. The experience of that thug was dumb. The experience of the sunset, or the road of the sun up in the Arctic, is dumb. There's no knowledge there. Now that I know, now I can enjoy the sunset, and I don't have to worry about if the sun's going to come up the next day. Now I can walk. Now I can actually walk down that path. I can see that same tree again, and I can still even feel that little bit of fear, like, oh, and then I can realize, oh, that's just a tree. My knowledge supersedes that experience, and it resolves that problem of that experience. So for me, there is no lack of self-experience. I don't need a new experience. In every experience, there's three things. There's the thing experienced, there is the experience itself, and then there's the experiencer. So I can try to change my experience by changing the things I experience. I can try to change my experience by changing my mind, by changing the thoughts. Or I can look to see what the very nature of the experiencer is. There is no lack of the experience. I inform every experience. I'm here in every experience. I shine as a conscious being in every experience. I don't need a new experience. I don't need a different experience. I just need to understand the true nature of every experience. Is it as I see it is? My experience is that the sun goes around in circles. My experience is that the sun comes up and goes down. Are either of those true? What is the truth of that? So, Yoga Sutra, the second sutra, says, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Some have taken that to mean yoga, you know, meditation, is Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Chitta means mind, vritti means a modification or thought. Nirodha, nirud, can mean a couple things. Nirodha can mean the elimination, the nasha, the destruction of the thoughts of the mind. That's yoga. Or it can mean mastery, the mastery of the ways of the mind, such that the mind does not lure you in and take you away, that you have choice when it comes to the mind. So if you think that you need to destroy the thoughts in your mind to see the truth of yourself, is that true? Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. The thing is that if the truth of myself is dependent on a state of mind, then when that state of mind changes, the truth of myself goes away. I am not dependent. I illumine all thoughts. I illumine the lack of thoughts. And we'll see this in meditation, and we'll see this in our classes. I illumine all thoughts. Thoughts come and go. States of mind come and go. The presence of a thought or the absence of a thought doesn't affect me. I, as a luminous, self-shining, existent being, am not dependent on a state of mind. I want ananta sukha. I want limitlessness. I want limitless purnatvam, completeness, fullness. If I go into a state of meditation, I'm saying meditation is beautiful, and even samadhi experiences can be extraordinary. I mean, the subtlety there is extraordinary. But do they solve the problem? An ignorant person goes in, a person whose ahankara, whose sense of identity, whose I notion, resolves in this limited jiva, I am this limited jiva, goes and has a mystical experience. goes and has a thoughtless experience where there's just awareness shining, and then comes back and says, I just had 2 hours of limitlessness, of eternity, right? How can you have 2 hours of, you're in meditation for 2 hours. How can I have 2 hours of eternity? You are the person that was there before the thoughtless state. You are the person who's there when the thoughts are gone, and you're the person there who's there when the thoughts come back. You're the person who's there during the dream state. You're the person who's there during the deep sleep state. You're the person who's there in a meditative state. It doesn't change. You still come back with this limited notion. Oh, I had this. Now I'm back. Now I'm a jiva. Now I have to keep trying to get that state back, this deep, blissful meditation state. That's a new experience. That's sort of spiritual materialism, as someone has said, has called it. And we just have more subtle experiences that we need to try to gain again to fill these gaps that we have, to fill these holes, because of the fundamental problem that wherein I mistake myself to be someone who still needs to be seeking new experiences, whether they be quote-unquote spiritual experiences or not. I need to understand the nature of the experiencer. Does a wave need to experience itself to know its water? Does it need to change its experience? No, the wave knows the wave is always wet. The wave cannot be any wetter, right? It doesn't need to be more watery. I need to change my experience because I'm not wet enough. I'm not watery enough. No, it is water. Its experience is pure water. It's nothing but water. The waterness doesn't go anywhere. It's completely available for its understanding. It doesn't need to experience more water. It needs to look and see that it is water. So let's look very quickly about action. This is a huge topic. The commentaries and the Shastras talk all about this, because there's this beginning part of the Veda called the Karma Kanda, which talks all about action, which all about rituals, all about how to get better circumstances. And then there's the Jnana Kanda, the Vedanta, the Upanishads, the end part of these texts, which talk about knowledge. And so there's these long dialogues about, you know, is moksha a combination of action and knowledge, or just action, or action supplemented with knowledge? Right now, since we don't have much time, and we can talk about that later, very briefly, actions, we talked about actions being mental, physical, and verbal. And action can only produce four different things. It can only do four different things, action, when you look at it. Utpadya, vikarya, samskarya, and apyam. An action can create something. It can create a pot. A pot wasn't there, utpadyam. It can create a pot. You can acquire something through an action. You can obtain something. I need a chair. I don't have anything to sit on. I go to the store. My action, I acquire a chair. I can make a pot. I can acquire a chair. Vikaryam, an action can transform something. Like milk turns into curds. Action can transform one thing into another thing. And lastly, samskarya. Action can clean something. Action can either remove an undesired quality, like you wipe off the dirt from a mirror, or it can add a new guna, a new quality, to make it shinier. Let's say you refringe the back of a mirror and it's more now lustrous because it's now shiny in back. To cut to the chase, does the wave need to create something to know that it's water? Does it need to make more foam? Does it need to create anything? No. Does it need to obtain something? Does it need, okay, well, there's these pieces of foam over here. I need to arrange my foam in such a way. I need to, here's a bag that's floating on top of me. Let me put this bag and I really need this. No, to become water. Does it need to? No. Does it need to transform itself into something? Well, if I were only water, I need to become water. I need to transform myself into water. I once went to this group where they had this song where they said, I am the wave, make me the ocean. I am the wave, make me the ocean. Meaning, I see myself as an individual, transform me into something bigger, into the total ocean. How do you transform a wave into the ocean? you tell it, you make it see that it's nothing but water. When the wave says, when the ocean says, me, when the ocean looks and says, I, when the totality, when Ishwara looks and says, me, I, it sees, when that ocean does that, it sees water. When the little wave looks and says, me, I, all there is water. You don't have to make the wave into the ocean. You just see that that wave is the water, which is no different than the truth of the entire ocean. So you don't need to become, transform into something else. And lastly, you don't, the water doesn't need to be purified. You don't need purified water. You know, I am said to be Atma, the self is said to be Nitya Shuddha Buddha, always pure. Nothing sticks to consciousness. I am not impure. There's nothing impure about me that needs to be clean like a mirror. And I'm always free. There's nothing time that I am. You can't improve on that. You can't improve on my Purnatvam that I'm always full. So we've seen that I don't need to do anything. I don't need to believe in anything. I don't need a new experience. And so what's left is knowledge. And so what we'll talk about next week is more about the nature of knowledge. We've been talking about this on and off for the last 3 weeks. We'll talk directly about the nature of knowledge, how one gets this knowledge, and then start the text. Let's sit for just a moment quietly. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimmahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yankshobarahitah brahmanah santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah Sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma satkamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amrtangamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vishishyate, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishwara Namaste. Any questions, thoughts? Some of this can be kind of controversial because we come with various notions of what spiritual activity is. And there is room for transformation. There is room for the idea of cleaning. It's just we have to see that the real cause of freedom of moksha is knowledge. And for example, the Gita gives a very beautiful vision of how one moves from tamas to rajas to sattva. It gives a very beautiful vision of how one goes from a very gross lifestyle to a very active lifestyle to a very contemplative, pure lifestyle. That's a transformation of the individual. But that transformation is limited because you're the same self that was that gross individual, was the same active individual, was it the same pure individual. So there is this, and we'll talk about, when we talk about adhikaratvam, when we talk about what qualities you need to hold this knowledge, it looks like there's a lot of inner purification that's going on. But really, it's not a purification of the self, it's just gaining the proper qualities so that one can clearly see this without any error, without any vagueness, without any doubt. So I just answered an unasked question.
Dakshaji, we can continue later if you are out of time, but I had a question if nobody else has a question.
Yes, if you need to leave, feel free, but I'm happy to stay as long as there's questions. Yes, Shankar.
Oh, okay. So Dakshaji, your example of that wave was really pretty enlightening in the sense that it's very much the ignorance part of it that is keeping the wave from not knowing it's a part of water or ocean, right? And Maya is something that is keeping the limit on our knowledge and our understanding of the universe or its working. So it is very much possible that even if the bigger wave says, okay, you are a part of the ocean or the water, believe it. Because of its limited knowledge, the smaller wave probably thinks it's only a wave and it thinks it's probably going to die when it hits the ocean shores, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I think most of the people live. I mean, I don't know what is going to happen after we all die. So like, although I might think, okay, there is something outside, that knowledge is not something that is easy unless, as you said, we have empirical data, and that is something that we don't have. So I don't know if it's a question, but I was just trying to see that we are always limited by knowledge, or like we only have ignorance and limited knowledge. But we can also perceive that there are things beyond that limited knowledge, but how to break that barrier and see the other side of things that is dark.
That's an excellent question, and that's exactly what I'm glad you have that question, because that's exactly what next week's class is going to be about. What are valid means of knowledge, and how are they limited? And if we need to know ourselves, you know, tattva bodha, knowledge of reality. How do you know reality? How is it available for us to know? Like you said, we don't know that there's a heaven. You know, we believe that there is. Some of us believe that there is because we have faith, we have trust in the books that tell us. You know, there seems to be trustworthy people who have this faith. And so we have this faith. But does the answer lie? Does freedom lie? Does the solution to our problem lie in going to heaven? You know, we could go, I've had people say, so you're going to have a very long dinner with God in heaven, and then you're going to come back. I've heard people say, no, all I want to do is be born as a leaf so Krishna can step with his foot on me. It's a very beautiful image. But the same texts that talk about how wonderful an afterlife can be say that you're going to come back and you're going to be in exactly the same position. So the only hope that there is for a spiritual life is if there's a solution right now, right? So if the truth of myself can solve the problem and set me free, and if I'm here right now for me to investigate the truth of myself, and I'm always going to be coming back to try to solve this fundamental problem, then there's hope. And in the end, you really see that there was no problem. That's really the final vision, that there really is no problem. But it's a long way to go in terms of our understanding, because right now there's so many things that to be understood. And the way to understand it, that's where the role, which we'll talk about next week, where the role of the Shastra and the role of the Guru, why you need a teacher. And we'll talk about who that teacher is and why they play such an important, what the qualities of that teacher is, and how the pramana will, we may not go into all the details of how a means of knowledge work, but there's a very specific way, very specific methodologies that are used to put your mind in such a position where you cannot help but see what is being said. And so if you see what's being said, you don't care that much about what happens in the afterlife, if there is an afterlife, because that itself is not the solution to the problem. I only seek an afterlife because I feel that I am mortal. And when you see the truth of yourself, you see that mortality does not come into the equation. I am not mortal. I can believe I am not mortal, but that really doesn't give me immortality. To see that the truth of myself is not subject to death, that's directly available because I am directly available to that means of knowledge. And so we need to talk a lot about that, what a pramana is, what a means of knowledge is. So I think that will begin to answer some of that question. Did that help?
Thanks, Dakshati. That was nice. Yeah. I also had one follow-up question, but we'll cover that in the next class or maybe next series. Which is essentially then what is the human experience? And if you just eliminate the physical part of our human body, is it the same across everybody? Is it like an energy source that is kind of like flushing through our system and going that we are trying to discover through this human body? More philosophical, I don't know if it's even related to what you're talking about, but it just gave me some food for thought, like when you were talking that, okay, maybe we are just, I don't know who said that, like we are all spiritual beings in human body rather than human experience in a spiritual body. I don't remember the exact sayings, but like it's something like, we are spiritual beings in human forms. That's what the conclusion was, rather than the other way around. So, I mean, that is something that is, we attach ourselves to our body and health and all these things, but that is one part of it. And the knowledge part of it, which is what you are covering, is I don't know how it's bound, but it is bound to the body, but it's also beyond that, right? So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, so there is a lot of material to cover, and when I say material, it's not just inferential knowledge. It is, we haven't gone into the very first part of, it all takes time to unfold. What needs to be unfolded is the nature of the individual. Who am I? Am I this energy that we're talking about? Am I this body? What's the relationship of me to this body? We started meditating on some of these energies, like you mentioned on prana today. There's five pranas in the body, and we'll talk about that. Prana, apana, vyana, udana, samana. And, what's my relationship with them? What's my relationship with the mind? What's my relationship with the intellect, with the psyche, with memories? Which even this I thought, this thought of I am, that seems to point to everything. So once you start that atma-vichara, once that becomes clearer and clearer and clearer, then that your questions, I think, will be answered. But we haven't really, I've hinted at that, but we haven't really begun to unfold that in a systematic way. And that will probably come in maybe two classes or three classes, because that's the very first thing. The whole Vedanta is tat tvam asi. This whole teaching is you, tvam, are tat, are that. So we need to understand. First thing you understand is what this tvam is called, tvam padavichara, this inquiry into the nature of you, into the nature of me. And that's the very foundation. And once you start to appreciate that, you start to free yourself from these confining notions that you have. And it's not just intellectual, it's not just theoretical, but it's immediately available. You see yourself and you start seeing that, yes, I am not as limited as I thought. And then it goes from there, and it just keeps going and going and going until you see that what you are is, we'll see what you are. But basically, you'll see that this, I can directly appreciate that. I am that which I seek. And so we also need to understand what this tat is, and this tat in tat-tvam-asi. Swamiji would say, I'm going to say the same thing at the first day of class as I am 3 years from now. Tat-tvam-asi, you are that. And he does. And he says it all along. And he says it again. And at the end, you go, oh, tat-tvam-asi, I see that. But it takes a lot of unfolding and kind of sitting with this. And I'd encourage people to have a daily meditation practice if you don't already. It's extraordinary. I don't feel like myself if I don't sit and meditate every morning. And once we start have some of this teaching under our belts, then we can start using that as material for contemplation, and it becomes even that much more deep.
Great. Thanks, Dakshati.
All right.
We'll see you next week.
Good, good. Thanks. It's very good having you all here in class. You, Mully, as well. I really am honored by your presence here. So
namaste.
Thank you very much. Namaskaram. Namaste.